Wise man, since if it weren't up to me, I'd do it anyhow. So. This morning I'm using contemporary poetry to talk about issues of faith and ethics. But I begin with two poems, actually a short one and an excerpt from a very long one, out of the 19th century. I say, by way of introduction, that they are poems written shortly after the Parliament of England decided that the male pronouns referred to all human beings. If you didn't know this was an act of Parliament that declared this. So I'm not changing the language in these two poems because we have the assurance of the House of Lords that that we women are included in the language. But I use these two poems to embody two different ways of looking at the world, and I'll read them in sequence and then say very briefly what I understand them to be embodying as ways of looking. The first is a little poem that many of you probably learned in grade school back when we learned poetry by heart. It's by Alfred Lord Tennyson called Flower in the Cranny. Flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you there, root and all, in my hand, little flower. But if I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is. This approach is the approach of dissection to try to understand the world. And Alfred Lord Tennyson knew that there is one major drawback to dissection. You end up with a dead plant. So pulling the plant out of its context in order to understand it is not the way to understanding God. And I would say not only man, but the world. And the poet has the insight to realize that that way is deadly. There's another poet that I only recently learned to appreciate. I had not run across her in academic work for reasons that are clear. She's female. Elizabeth Barrett Browning's work. And this is a marvelous feminist poem written in the 1850s called Aurora Leigh. Any of you know it? Aurora Leigh? It's a wonderful early feminist poem. But this passage doesn't deal with feminist issues explicitly, but certainly does indirectly. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries and daub their natural faces, unaware more and more from the first similitude. That poetic language means that after Eden, after the first similitude of the Imago Dei, people lose the awareness that every common bush is afire with God. They no longer take off their shoes when coming down the mountain, realizing no longer that God is incarnate in absolutely every element of the universe. Fortunately, Luther was one who knew that God was incarnate in every element of the universe, and that understanding of ubiquity informed his understanding of the Eucharist. And by the end of this lecture, I will recycle around to that theme again. So that by way of introduction. Elizabeth Barrett Browning is suggesting that instead of dissecting, you leave things in their location, in their place, and only there can you understand their meaning in living context. If you pluck out the flower, it dies. If you stand in awe of the common bush afire with God, it's there also for communal awe and for awe in later generations. Now, I begin with a contemporary poet who is very young, 11 years old. I want to read two of these poems and then talk about them. They're from a series called No Name Poems. This is an 11-year-old boy writing. I hear a cry, a very loud cry. As it gets closer, it's panther, a black panther. It leaps on me, and as it does, I feel it's the time. As I go, the one thing I will remember is love. Never will I forget the one thing everybody needs, love. The second poem is, I'm going on a journey. I don't know why I'm going, but I want to find something, something special, something that will last forever. In that poem, there's the impetus of the poet wanting to create in order that the decay of passing time will not be able to destroy what is most precious. Somehow, poetry is able to condense experience and give us the possibility of holding on over against inevitable decay. The third poem of this young poet is another dimension of poetry. As I walk down the aisle of a store, I see a Hershey Kiss, and I buy it. When I get home, I eat it. And that's the end of the Hershey Kiss. The first two poems of this poet could be interpreted, if you're into family origin stuff, I suppose, as being a little heavy. And it's the third poem which reminds us of the levity of the 11-year-old. But I read the first two also because we forget how perceptive children are of the intensity of human life on the planet. And when I get home, I'll call up Peter Colin Blair in Seattle because he's my nephew. Nice kid, actually. He's a great soccer player. And his only flaw is that he's not a Celtics fan. Now, I'm doing two sets of poems for the remainder. The first, it's unusual for me to do it this way, but I think it's probably better for our purposes. I'm going to start with contemporary poetry dealing with religious issues, and then move to questions that are more explicitly social justice issues. I have become a great fan of a poet named Mary Oliver, whom I hope many of you know. If not, you have a real treat coming. And I will begin and finally end with two of her poems. The first one is called Some Questions You Might Ask. This is from a collection called House of Light. Some questions you might ask. Is the soul solid like iron? Or is it tender and breakable, like the wings of a moth in the beak of an owl? Who has it and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does it have a shape like an iceberg, like the eye of a hummingbird? Does it have one lung like the snake and the scallop? Why should I have it and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about the little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass? Theologically, that's a very threatening poem for a lot of people who are quite sure that what distinguishes the human from everything else in creation is that God gave us a soul. And the poet has the courage to ask us to contemplate the possibility that Homo sapiens is not so sapiens as all that. That we are more bound to the rest of creation, to the common bush afire with God, than our most orthodox theology often has led us to think. Is the soul solid like iron? Well, What do you think? Asks the poet. The second poem moves into the Christological form of that, and I will read it and then talk about it a bit. It's a prose poem. If Jesus came to town, I'd take him over to the Jewish deli on Beacon Street. We'd have apple strudel with dough as thin as layers of snowflakes, and apple as sweet as a bud opening in May. I'd ask him if he likes kosher dill pickles, too. Sitting, sipping coffee with Jesus, if he drinks coffee, I'd hope for an easy joy which would make courage unnecessary, and I'd ask him, do you still feel forsaken? I wrote that sitting in a deli on Beacon Street in Boston, eating apple strudel, and the question that arises for me out of that poem is the question of time in relationship to Christology. Does the Christ remain forsaken forever by the first person of the Trinity? Or does resurrection somehow impose strict linearity on the connection between Jesus and the Christ? There's partly an answer in the next poem, again by Mary Oliver. This poem is called, the title is important, this poem is called Maybe. Sweet Jesus, talking is melancholy madness, stood up in the boat and the sea lay down, silky and sorry. So everybody was saved that night. But you know how it is when something different crosses the threshold, the uncles mutter together, the women walk away, the young brother begins to sharpen his knife. Nobody knows what the soul is. It comes and goes like the wind over the water. Sometimes for days you don't think of it. Maybe after the sermon, after the multitude was fed, one or two of them felt the soul slip forth like a tremor of pure sunlight before exhaustion, that wants to swallow everything, exhaustion gripping their bones and leaving them miserable and sleepy, as they are now, forgetting how the wind tore at the sails. Before he rose and talked to it, tender and luminous and demanding as he always was, a thousand times more frightening than the killer sea. I would like us to talk about the frightening part of that Jesus of Nazareth, the one who dared to be forsaken by God, and the one who understood cooperation with the world of benign nature. And one intimation of how to understand that frightening part of Jesus is in poems by contemporary African Americans. Lucille Clifton is an African-American poet whose work I confess I only belatedly learned about thanks to students who introduced her to me. And this is called Spring Song. The green of Jesus is breaking the ground, and the sweet smell of delicious Jesus is opening the house, and the dance of Jesus music has hold of the air, and the world is turning in the body of Jesus, and the future is possible. The green of Jesus is breaking the ground, and the sweet smell of delicious Jesus is opening the house, and the dance of Jesus music has hold of the air, and the world is turning in the body of Jesus, and the future is possible. That poem suggests that there is an integral connection between the ubiquity of God and eschatology. How is hope made possible for the future? By understanding that the universe turns in the body of Jesus. A poem of transition now is by a poet that many of you know because you read Lutheran Partners. Her name is Kathleen O'Keefe Reed, pastor up in Vermont. And this poem is called Creatio ex Nihilo, Creation Out of Nothing. Putting her hands on hips that would not have been known to exist except in such moments, she expands an equally ephemeral breast with the breathing of a satisfied sigh that wants to be eternal. She looks down upon her latest creation and says to herself, "Hattie, you sure did blend your colors nicely this time." She is the rag rug woman, gatherer of good for nothing, weaver of worth, expert in creatio ex nihilo. Her joy, any ball of cloth not fit for dust. Whatever is worn out, she receives. Just dump it right here on the kitchen table where her hands hover over the chaos, where fingers dance with scissors, thread, and needle, making strands of life emerge. From rags, she weaves works of art you can walk on, solid spirals with centers you can stand in and look into, finding the pieces. The snowsuit you wore the day you steered your sled into a tree. Where did the blood go? The uniform your father wore home from the war. Where did the blood go? The scarf you had on the day your lover locked you out. Where did the blood go? For the first time, it all makes sense. I like this poem as an example of the way women are writing poetry on religious themes in the contemporary period. It's a poem that takes seriously the images that we have inherited from the tradition, takes seriously the theology that has been inherited from the tradition, but uses the experience of everyday things, to use Adrienne Rich's phrase, to build up the poetic images. This is poetry and theology out of the ordinariness of daily life. And it's poetry and theology on themes that all of us experience, but hardly ever talk about in church. Especially the line, "The scarf you had on, the day your lover locked you out, where did the blood go?" is a line that talks about violence in domestic life in ways that raise questions about the theology of family that we often use in the church. And that takes me to the next poem called Powerful Words. There's a new book, I believe, I just saw the other day by Martha Jansen. She's a Lutheran woman. Did any of you see that reference to a new book of her poems? This is from a collection called Silent Scream, and the poem is called Powerful Words. Everybody has a word or two that carries extra power. For some, they are four-letter words, coarse, dramatic, or attacks on religion. No-no words that call up shocks of the heart, imbalance of senses, ugly thoughts. Everyone has some of these words. I was amazed to learn from friends that two of my powerful words are not shocking or blasphemous to them or to most people. All these years, my heart pounded and my mind worried whenever I heard them said. I wouldn't say them aloud. My words were touch and kiss. Through the medium of art, we can come to an empathic understanding of experiences which might not be our own, or experiences which were our own but we didn't remember that we had. In that poem, we are brought into contact with the world and experience of a person who is in the subheading of the title of the collection, Silent Scream, I Am a Victim of Incest. Contemporary poetry deals a lot with violence against children. And there's a woman who lives in Oregon named Joyce Baxter, published a collection of poems privately called The Mellow Yellow Camel, Confessions of a School Bus Driver. She was in a class down at PSR several years ago, and I feel really privileged to have a copy of this collection of poems. And one of the themes in the poem, in the collection, is the life of a little boy named Ricky. And the first one is called This Boy Ricky. This boy Ricky sits carefully in his seat, belted in and looking out the window at the nothing his life has always been. Nothing given and nothing to give back but anger spontaneously generated, growing out of rotting memories. Red prints of violation bruise his face, sturdy face made for sudden smiles, for shouting wonder, a face destined not to bear the mark of his true self. The bruises leak from inner wounds, pain of being born when no one wants the you that you will be. Life is smashed on the surface of his skin, and it pools in chambers of despair. There are no tears for this boy, this Ricky. There never have been. There is only dust and blood and crushed dreams. Isn't it better this way, you say? Then he won't have hopes for more than he is worth. What can this boy be worth in a house of sudden death? Is he worthy? Is he worthy of the clothing donated by some dedicated saints? Is he worthy to be understood at the moment when his anger rips like winter's whip over the silence of his classroom? How will we ever know the value of this boy, this Ricky, who, when he leaves the clamor of the bus, melts into the surrounding nothingness? There are very few poets before the 20th century who attended to that dimension of childhood. And it's one of the gifts of contemporary poets to enable us to read about that experience even before we're ready to know about it. The last poem in this sequence is Elizabeth McKim's I Have Always Been. I have always been a lonely woman, even in the beginning, not understanding the language of men, always wanting them to see me, always hiding from them, hoping they will not crush me with their anger, trying to make them smile with my masks, my veils, my dancing costumes, my magic, and my bells, so they would stop scaring me, so they would fall asleep, so I could take their power. Maybe we'll come back to that one in the discussion. The last segment is a series of poems on social justice themes. And one of my favorites is a Native American contemporary poet named Joy Harjo. One of the reasons I'm doing poetry is because far too many of us think we don't have time to read poetry anymore, so my mission is to re-enliven that in our theological work. But especially the poetry of people outside the dominant culture in the United States. And Joy Harjo is one of the brilliant contemporary poets writing in the United States. And this poem, which I use in every lecture I do on poetry, is called The Woman Hanging from the 13th Floor Window. The Woman Hanging from the 13th Floor Window. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window. Her hands are pressed white against the concrete molding of the tenement building. She hangs from the 13th floor window in East Chicago with a swirl of birds over her head. They could be a halo or a storm of glass waiting to crush her. She thinks she will be set free. The woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago is not alone. She is a woman of children, of the baby Carlos, and of Margaret, and of Jimmy, who is the oldest. She is her mother's daughter and her father's son. She is several pieces between the two husbands she has had. She is all the women of the apartment building who stand watching her, watching themselves. When she was young, she ate wild rice on scraped-down plates in warm wood rooms. It was in the farther north, and she was the baby then. They rocked her. She sees Lake Michigan lapping at the shores of herself. It is a dizzy hole of water, and the rich live in tall glass houses at the edge of it. In some places, Lake Michigan speaks softly. Here, it just sputters and butts itself against the asphalt. She sees other buildings just like hers. She sees other women hanging from the many floored windows, counting their lives in the palms of their hands and in the palms of their children's hands. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the Indian side of town. Her belly is soft from her children's births. Her worn Levi's swing down below her waist, and then her feet, and then her heart. She is dangling. The woman hanging from the 13th floor window hears voices. They come to her in the night when the lights have gone dim. Sometimes they are little cats mewing and scratching at the door. Sometimes they are her grandmother's voice. And sometimes they are gigantic men of light whispering to her to get up, to get up, to get up. That's when she wants to have another child to hold on to in the night, to be able to fall back into dreams. And the woman hanging from the 13th floor window hears other voices. Some of them scream out from below for her to jump. They would push her over. Others cry softly from the sidewalks, pull their children up like flowers, and gather them into their arms. They would help her like themselves. But she is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window, and she knows she is hanging by her own fingers, her own skin, her own thread of indecision. She thinks of Carlos, of Margaret, of Jimmy. She thinks of her father and of her mother. She thinks of all the women she has been, of all the men. She thinks of the color of her skin and Chicago streets and of waterfalls and pines. She thinks of moonlight nights and of cool spring storms. Her mind chatters like neon and Northside bars. She thinks of the 4 a.m. lonelinesses that have folded her up like death, discordant, without logical and beautiful conclusion. Her teeth break off at the edges. She would speak. The woman hangs from the 13th floor window, crying for the lost beauty of her own life. She sees the sun falling west over the gray plain of Chicago. She thinks she remembers listening to her own life break loose as she falls from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago, or as she climbs back up to claim herself again. I think in our congregations, if we studied that poem, we would learn a lot about racism in the church, a lot about economic justice, and a lot about sexism. It might be a good poem to use in an adult study session some morning. And pose the question to the group. Pose it to yourself right now. Did she jump? At the end of the poem, and why? Another theme in that poem that I like especially is the question of the boundaries between the individual self and the communal self, one of the themes that has emerged in this week. She is not only herself, but all women and indeed all men in this poem, and that is a theme that will build in the remaining poems this morning. One of the great gifts of Yahweh Sophia Gaia to the universe is Alice Walker. And she has a collection of poems called Horses Make a Landscape Look More Beautiful, which is a Lakota Sioux saying. I suspect that the book will get read more in 1992. I hope it will, because it has to do with the relationships of immigrant whites and Native Americans largely. But not only, and this poem is called A Few Sirens. Think of where you like to sit when you think, whether you're writing a sermon or thinking about the children or thinking about how in the world to pay for the groceries. Where do you like to sit when you think? And have that in mind as you listen to this poem. Today I am at home writing poems. My life goes well. Only a few sirens herald disaster in the ghetto down the street. In the world, people die of hunger. On my block, we lose jobs, housing, and breasts. But in the world, children are lost. Whole countries of children starve to death before the age of 5 each year. Their mothers squatted in the filth around the empty cooking pot, wondering. But I cannot pretend to know what they wonder. A walled horror instead of thought would be my mind, and our children gladly starve themselves. Thinking of the food I eat every day, I want to vomit, like people who throw up at will, understanding that whether they digest or not, they must continue. Can you imagine? Rather than let the hungry inside the restaurants, let them eat vomit, they say. They are applauded for this. They are light. But wasn't there a time when food was sacred? When a dead child, starved naked among the oranges in the marketplace, spoiled the appetite? Lisa Weiss, Houston Street. They huddle over garbage fires, moving from foot to foot, heat passing quickly through their rags. They gulp coffee gleaned from the pockets of passersby, fresh from showers, where hot water is never a miracle, from homes where thick rolls of toilet paper are never luxuries. They never ask me for money. Something uncertain in my newly leathered feet tells them, something uncertain in the way I clutch my morning token tells them there is a thin line between us. We are not busy people hurrying to breakfast in steamy cafes, to offices where coffee perks all day. In the evening, a man in a Playboy hat, face down in the gutter, empty bottles, pools of puke, the one-legged man still hustling to polish windshields. A man on a stoop asks me for a cigarette. I see my brother in his broken teeth, matted hair. My groceries grow heavy in my arms. He asks me to marry him, the only man who ever dared. I laugh and wink. He knows, I know, how these greasy streets feel to cold bare feet. We both know how quickly the fine line between us melts. The increasing identification with the distanced other is one of the themes running through this last set. And I turn for that again to Lucille Clifton, an unnamed poem. The body's broken on the trail of tears, and the body's melted in middle passage, are married to rock and ocean by now, and the mountains crumbling on white men, the waters pulling white men down, sing for red dust and black clay, good news about the earth. That is a 1992 poem, and another of Lucille Clifton's, of the last three, called Sorrow Song. For the eyes of the children, the last to melt, the last to vaporize, for the lingering eyes of the children staring, the eyes of the children of Buchenwald, of Vietnam and Johannesburg, for the eyes of the children of Nagasaki, for the eyes of the children of Middle Passage, for Cherokee eyes, Ethiopian eyes, Russian eyes, American eyes, for all that remains of the children, their eyes staring at us, amazed to see the extraordinary evil in ordinary men. That theme of the locus of responsibility for contemporary evil is posed in the last poem of the problem sequence, and that is "The House That Fear Built," Warsaw, 1943. This poem does what a lot of contemporary women poets do. It takes an old children's rhyme and builds it into new meaning. There's an opening quotation from Czesław Miłosz, whom I'd never heard of until I read this poem, and since then I read him voraciously. He wrote in a poem, "The purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain just one person. For our house is open. There are no keys to the doors. How difficult it is to remain just one person." Separation in the themes of last night's and the other lecture. So Jane Flanders in Timepiece has this poem called "The House That Fear Built," Warsaw, 1943. "I am the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the woman with lowered gaze who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the man in the overcoat who loves the woman with lowered gaze, who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the stranger who photographs the man in the overcoat who loves the woman with lowered gaze, who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. The crowd of which I am each part moves on beneath my window, for I am the crone, too, who shakes her sheets over every street in the world, muttering, 'What's this? What's this?'" The borders of the self, whether the sinner or the faithful self, are significantly blurred in much of contemporary poetry. Trying to keep sharp dichotomies between male and female, or white and black, or straight and gay, trying to keep those dichotomies is very difficult, reading the poetry of contemporary poets. And for some, that's very threatening. To hear poetry which challenges that sharp bifurcation of reality is for many people unnerving because the foundations begin to shake. I'll read one more poem and then talk a bit about Eucharistic interpretations of this kind of poetry that I do, and then see about conversation with you. The final poem in this sequence is again by Mary Oliver, and it's called "Sunrise." I like it a lot for one reason. I found this poem shortly, the day before I was fired from my job at Boston University. I'd given this brilliant prose poem speech. It was one of those speeches that you just sit down and write. I mean, it just came. And a theme of the poem, an image that pervaded it, was the image of fire and how prophets have to enter fire in order to critique the dominant culture. So the next day I got fired, which shows that God has a sense of humor. And it was really very, very interesting experience. And the poem that I heard about very soon after that was this poem called "Sunrise." You can die for it, an idea, or the world. People have done so brilliantly, letting their small bodies be bound to the stake, creating an unforgettable fury of light. But this morning, climbing the familiar hills in the familiar fabric of dawn, I thought of China and India and Europe, and I thought how the sun blazes for everyone just so joyfully as it rises under the lashes of my own eyes. And I thought, I am so many. What is my name? What is the name of the deep breath I would take over and over for all of us? Call it whatever you want. It is happiness. It is another one of the ways to enter fire. I have in the copy I use of this poem a note at the bottom. It says, "This is similar to the best of Eucharistic ethics in Lutheran tradition." This is similar to the best of ethics in Lutheran tradition. Why? Early in the Reformation, when Luther wrote treatises on the Mass, he connected the event of grace in the Eucharist with social justice. My notion is that the Reformation was as much about the impoverishment of the masses as it was about justification by grace through faith. Indeed, the one can't be talked about completely without the other. And Luther was ticked off at the ripping off of the people economically by the church. When he talked about the Eucharist, the images he used were images of embodiment in the corporate body. And in those early treatises in 15, 18, and 19, he said that in the Eucharist, when you participate in the body and the blood of the Christ, you are, his words, turned into each other. Turned into each other. And then he elaborates the metaphor as the flour and the salt and the yeast and the water are completely intermingled in the bread of the Eucharist, and as the grapes are completely united in the wine, so that you can no longer separate out the individual components, so when you participate in the Eucharist, you can no longer separate yourself out as an autonomous individual from the body. I love that imagery, not because it's fusion. You don't lose yourself completely. You just find your true identity in that corporate Christic body. But then he takes it another step further. It's not only the worshiping community that is this exchange of identity, but it's the entire community outside the church for Luther. So that the participation in the Eucharist means, to use his words, that you take on the neighbor outside the community as well. And I think for Lutheran social ethics, that means what these poems are talking about. To take grace seriously is for the straight, white, heterosexual male to take on the identity of the gay white male. It's for the white woman to take on the identity of the Cherokee woman. Take your favorite bifurcation of human identity, your favorite other. What Luther is arguing is that grace refuses to let us sit in those dichotomies. I think that's a tremendous challenge for the ELCA these days, which seems institutionally bound to deny that part of our tradition. Separating out, especially gay men and lesbians, from the identity of the true body. But in this series of poems, as I've selected it, it's not only sexuality issues. We can simply talk about male-female. I think there are many in this group who aren't very comfortable with changes of identity of male and female in contemporary culture. Who find this kind of poetry, in fact, this insistence on the corporate identity of the human as threatening to the autonomy of especially male psyches. On issues of race, the theme running through here has been the theme spoken by the other than whites. Not non-whites, because whites aren't normative, but the other than whites. And that perspective challenges the dominant separation of whites. The theme of money has also been in these poems. So I use contemporary poetry to make sure that when I reflect theologically on what God is about, I'm not reflecting on an academic idea, but rather questions posed by people actually living in the culture. That brings up new interpretations of the relationship between the human and the natural world, the rest of the natural world. It brings up questions of bridging dichotomies that we have used as chasms. So those are some of the poems that I think bring questions to the church out of the culture. And I solicit any responses you might have, and I don't know how comfortable you are hearing poetry and then talking about it, so we'll see. Yes?
In one of the first poems, you mentioned how the spirit being present in the grass and everything would be very threatening to, and then you said our orthodoxy. And I think the our was very important there, because if you just said orthodoxy, it wouldn't have been true.
That's right.
And yet, it's interesting that those theologies, Catholic, the Orthodox, which most tend to be aware of the sacramental presence of God through all reality in various degrees, are exactly those traditions which insist upon the masculine priesthood.
Yeah.
My assumption is that has to do with the fact that because the affirmation of the feminine is so strong in the theology, that there is a great fear or intuitive awareness of losing the tension between the feminine and the masculine, and therefore the masculine liturgically has to be represented very prominently. If we, as we have chosen in our tradition, not to up to that prominence, to meld it into the feminine masculine, how do we deal with what I think is a very real and perhaps reality-based fear of the masculine to lose representation in this tension that we have to maintain that Dr. Steinke has talked about between the masculine, feminine, for our sense of a human identity to continue?
Mm-hmm. I'll set aside the some questions in the Roman Catholic Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox issues, and speak only to the last point. I can't speak to men's fear of losing the masculine in religion.
It's not just men's fear.
Oh, but the women, and there are women-identified men who also have that fear, but it's men's fear originally that women then vicariously appropriate. And there are women who do that. I don't know how men maintain their identity in a non-dualistic view of sexuality. I don't know how you do that. I'm not in a position to speak to you about that because I'm not you. What I do know is that so far, a dualistic interpretation of male and female in Protestant theology has always led to the subordination of the female theologically. The dualistic thinking is zero-sum thinking. That means that people who have dualistic notions assume that it has to be either or, that the gain of the one has to be to the detriment of the other. There's only a certain finite pie of identity that can be divvied up, and if some of it becomes more female, that thinking says the masculine side has to lose. I think that's a very good example of masculine dualistic thinking, held not only by males of the species, but it's masculine dualistic thinking. It's quite possible to say that the more we embody both, however we define that then as a social definition, masculinity and femininity, or maleness and femaleness, in our theological image systems, the more we use both, the richer and more complete the theology will be. That's not zero sum, that's saying that it is by addition that we obtain some plethora of metaphors for the deity. And part of our problem is that we do image analysis without first looking at those two very different ways of construing reality. We can't talk about God language and sort of come to some agreement there until we decide, are we going to operate as if the universe were always divided into bipolar opposites? Or are we going to operate with a metaphor, to use examples of several, the web metaphor, the weaving metaphor, the rag rug metaphor, which are not metaphors of bipolar opposites, but metaphors of never losing even the most apparently insignificant remnant. That's all incorporated into the creative image. Am I missing completely your concern?
Not missing completely, but I don't see how you guard you're guarding yourself against the risk of fusion, as our other speaker did.
Because I think it would be wonderful if sometime we did a light conference and had some real dialogue among the presenters. I think it's crucial to articulate how the self is simultaneously individual and social. And when I talk, you hear fusion because you hear that I am forgetting that the self is individual. You hear it as if I'm saying only the social side.
I assume you're not forgetting. I want to know how that is represented so that it is affirmed in some visible fashion.
But how do you want me to say it with regard to the fear of losing masculine identity in theology? Yeah. See, and my concern is, how can we finally get female identity in this? Yeah. How can we get enough so that we could be worried about losing it? I don't mean by that to downplay the seriousness of the worry, because I know. When men get worried about losing their identity, I'm in danger.
That's right.
And the work of Robert Bly has been trashed by a lot of feminists, I think some who haven't read some of Bly's material, but at least he's dealing with that fear seriously. And I think in some imaginative ways. Theologically, I think there's a way to deal with it. That might sound a little formulaic, but I don't understand how men can possibly be worried about the integrity of their own self if they believe justification by grace. I know. I know. And, you know, I'm a convert to Lutheran. I was not raised on this, and if there was one reason I became one, it was because of justification by grace. And that says to me that we do not have to justify ourselves by gender bifurcation in an opposition sense. That we can hang loose about all these other identities because justification is by grace. And not by whether you're straight or gay. Or male or female. But so you're asking me to deal with a very serious problem that many men are having. Many men are very threatened these days because their little kingdoms have collapsed, frankly. I'm sorry that my life is finite just like yours is, and my concern is how to help the wives that these guys are battering. And I hope that you are helping the guys. And if we can then, being grapes put together in the Eucharistic wine, distribute the work, then I don't have to go around helping all the men, and you don't have to go around helping all the women, and maybe he wants to help the women. We can diversify.
Somehow they are justified as men liturgically, and that's getting harder to do.
It is?
I see that I in the perception of the men as they talk to me, yes, that this idea of religion is a woman's thing is, I see it surfacing again.
Yeah, and you're very astute in saying again, because it recycles every time there's a feminist movement in the world. And you can, it's a marvelous material of the 19th century. If we let these women do this, the men won't show up in the church anymore, and it'll all turn feminized. And, you know, so, but what is that? That's saying, if we let them have any part of this, they will take it all. Now, that says a lot about male fear, doesn't it?
Paranoid, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not so paranoid. I mean, we are interested in getting a lot of it. That's right. Half. Half. Other questions or comments? Go ahead.
Of sharing the power, which would fit right in with that justification where we're all equal now and we can work together and interact with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, again, that's very threatening for people who understand that the only way they can exercise their power is exclusively in a hierarchical model.
Over and against.
Yes, over and against. So we need to talk again about that different way of seeing the world before we get to the particular forms of expressing it.
Did your perception of whether the woman climbed up on the sill or jumped off, does that change from time to time?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, when I read, well, I'm not known for not being full of candor. When I read 66 male bishops tell me that I have to use exclusively masculine terminology to baptize legitimately, I'm sure she jumped. Serious. I'm serious. This is that dimension of Christianity which says to be born of woman is negative. You must be born again in the waters of baptism. And in this new birth process, the birth giver is exclusively masculine. What is that doing? That's saying we've got an either-or system. We've got to take away the first birth from women and make the new birth the real birth, and it's all generated by an exclusively masculine deity. And the only legitimate way to become a member of this wonderful, diverse body called the church is to come through exclusively male birth in baptism. Now, friends, that's a problem. And it might be, maybe we can get at it through family origin stuff. I don't know. Any device that can help us understand how a church can be so concerned about female power that it makes the dominant symbol system exclusively masculine, any way we can get insight into that will be all to the good. This, I very frankly, I'm terribly worried about the church because it is unable to delight in the potential of women. And it's a long historical problem, but it keeps getting, it's getting intensified lately. So there are times when I think this woman jumped. There are other times when I'm quite sure that she came back in. And usually when she crawls back into the window, there's a group of women inside. And they're mutually empowering, and maybe even then it gets to the point where there are some men who aren't afraid to join that group. You know, but so far, I couldn't count the number of times, and I've been in church meetings talking with another woman, and a man will come up and say, "What are you plotting?" Two women together constitute a revolution from any male perspective in the church. And usually they're right, but I'm not admitting that. Yes. Yeah. An easy joy which would make courage unnecessary.
When you read that, I thought, and then hearing the comment too about male fear, I thought that is exactly what should sort of be above our Eucharistic faith. Whenever we gather, it's exactly what it should be.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I stay in this difficult thing called the church, because I can't get out, but because I'm so intrigued with Jesus, with a Jesus who is a radical revolutionary male rabbi, with whom I could sit down and have that conversation. Without worrying that he's running male-female tapes through his head all the time. Any other comments or questions? Yes. You say the medium, do you mean the medium of poetry or the kind of conversation that's been taking place, what I've been saying now?
I mean your tone of voice, your body language, your sarcastic remarks.
I think there's some truth in that. I think you're reading correctly. There are certain situations where, when I speak, that conversations that have happened outside the sessions, comments that I've overheard when people didn't know I was, remind me again that women are not safe. And part of the problem is that in structural injustice, each of us as an individual might say, well, I'm not dangerous. But I'll use the situation of racism so that I put myself in where I think you are in the situation in sexism. I work very hard, both where I work at the Women's Theological Center. We are deeply committed to working on racism, classism, heterosexism, and sexism equally. And it's very difficult work. I realize that when I walk down the streets of Boston, the fact that I am deeply committed to fighting my own racism is invisible. I walk down the street as a white. And if eventually the drugs are no longer shipped in to Roxbury and Dorchester, so that the rising up will happen, the fact that I'm a deeply committed white working against racism is not going to make one whit of difference. I'm going to be white. The same thing with men. You might be the absolutely sweetest guy on God's sweet earth, friend. But I look at you right now, after these few days, as one of the men. You're hearing a slight, perhaps you would call it defensiveness in me. I'm saying, Elizabeth, you are not ever really safe on this planet. But on the other hand, I'm still standing up here talking. because I think I really do believe in grace. So you're picking up very accurately, especially this morning, I think. It's a way of putting a protective wall, because frankly, I don't trust you. I don't know who you are as an individual. I don't know. And it might, maybe after, if I knew you for 20 years, I don't know. But this morning, I don't trust you. And you know what that is? It's called sexism.
Well, I think perfect fear casts out love.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And if in the time that I've been talking, it hadn't been the case that at least 10 women have been murdered by their husbands or lovers in the United States, I might feel a little different about my obligation to love you. And I just won't in the church say that that I will be bound by the obligation of perfect love when I'm not God. I'm a sinner. But that's a socially located phenomenon. I didn't read the Warsaw poem for nothing, my friend. I'm scared spitless as a woman in this culture, but the Warsaw poem says that I also am in the position of the men, which I find Lutheran theology to be able to deal with. So imagine how I feel. But I celebrate your willingness to say what you have, because most of the time people think it but don't say it. And it gives me the opportunity to try to be clear about what I'm feeling. And wouldn't it be marvelous if more frequently in the church we could have that kind of honest exchange instead of pretending that everything's fine?
Please. Oh,
please.
I want to say that when my wife and I get into a fight, she kind of tells me what I'm doing wrong, and I kind of tell her what she's doing wrong, and the fight lasts a long time. And when I start to look at myself and stay out of her shit, and she stays out of mine, then the fight gets resolved pretty fast.
Well, women spend most of our lives cleaning up other people's shit. Well, somebody's got to change the diapers, which Luther said was one of the most faithful things you can do. You see, I hear several centuries of the masculine attempt to keep conflict with women very controlled and quickly over. You adopt the autonomy model of dealing with each other's shit. You deal with yours, she deals with hers. I'm not any great shakes on knowing whether that works or not. You and she have to know about that. But I know that a lot of the injustice that I and other women and men encounter is because we haven't really been willing to use your image now to sit a long time in each other's shit. And until we're willing to do that, we kid ourselves in thinking that we really know the other. The other is just really some projection of what we think about the other. And I find this no more clearly than in issues on racism. And not only, and it's not only to be willing to sit where the injustice is, but I think a woman who's a co-director at the Women's Theological Center, Donna Bivens, we had a marvelous conversation about racism. She's African-American. And she said, you know, this problem of racism won't really be dealt with in the United States until whites can start saying what's positive about being white. I think that's one of the most brilliant insights I've ever heard on the issue of racism. She immediately says, whites, you've got to start realizing that your experience is not universal. And as I've started trying to do it, that's a tough one. What's positive about being white? And there is a lot, but it takes a lot of corporate work to get to it. The same thing on sex. We as women will not really be equally vulnerable and free and empowered with men until you men can start saying what's positive about being male and masculine. Okay, it's quite appropriate for you to say more. Don't say you want to say one thing and then shut up.
Well, I just thought that there were other people who were doing the chant that's also doing.
You dream. It's coffee time. Thank you.
Elizabeth, we thank you for your human courage, candor, and Lutheran understanding of justification by grace. Thank you very much for being with us. You've opened up many windows, and the dialogue continues. Thank you. Have a break. Back at 1:45.